What if I told you that simply by changing your zip code without getting a raise or, changing your career, you could generate over $250,000 in invisible wealth over the next 20 years?
Right. Just by sitting in a completely different living room.
Exactly. I mean, you are sitting there in Texas right now. Yeah. The air conditioning is absolutely blasting, right? It's struggling to keep up because it's like maybe the 20th day in a row where the thermometer has just casually strolled past 100 degrees.
Oh, yeah. You can hear the AC unit just fighting for its life.
Seriously. And on the table in front of you, sitting right there next to your iced tea, is this piece of mail you've been dreading for weeks. It's your annual property tax assessment.
The absolute worst piece of mail you get all year.
It really is. So you look at that number, and then you look out the window at the heat waves literally shimmering and, distorting the asphalt on your street. And a thought crosses your mind. A really serious, potentially life-altering thought.
You think, what if I just left?
Yes. What if I packed it all up, sold this house, and went somewhere where the air is actually cool? Somewhere where fresh water is everywhere, and where I don't have to pay this massive escalating subscription fee just to exist in my own home?
And if that scenario sounds even remotely familiar to you, well, you are exactly who we're talking to today. We are taking a deep dive into a very specific, increasingly common modern migration.
The Texas to Bellingham, Washington pipeline.
Right. It's a migration pattern that has, transitioned from a trickle of retirees to a highly crystallized pipeline for working professionals and families.
And to really understand the mechanics of this, we are looking at a comprehensive 2026 relocation guide and cost analysis.
Yeah, this data comes directly from Gennaro Schaefer. He's a licensed real estate broker up in Bellingham who has orchestrated this exact Texas to Washington transition for dozens of clients.
So he actually knows what he's talking about.
Exactly. He has run the numbers, tracked the equity transfers, and mapped out exactly what this transition requires from both a financial and a psychological standpoint.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission for this deep dive is not to sell you on the Pacific Northwest. We are not reading a glossy tourism brochure about evergreen trees and mountain views.
No, not at all.
Our mission is to look at the brutal, unvarnished math. We are going to examine the genuine lifestyle trade-offs, the hidden consumption taxes, and the massive environmental shifts.
Because the profound psychological adjustment required to trade the intense Texas sun for the persistent Pacific Northwest gray is, well, it's huge.
The data makes one thing incredibly clear here. This is not just a lateral move. You aren't just swapping one suburb for another.
It is a complete reset of how you live, how you build wealth, and how you interact with the environment around you.
So whether you are actively organizing a moving pod in your driveway right now, or you're just sitting in the AC daydreaming about a cooler climate, we're going to give you the exact numbers and emotional preparation you need for a pivot of this magnitude.
But before we analyze the financial mechanics of Bellingham, we really have to establish the baseline. We need to examine the launch pad.
Right. Like, why leave in the first place?
Exactly. Why are Texans people who historically possess a very deep, profound cultural pride in their home state suddenly looking 2,000 miles to the Northwest?
It's a fair question.
The relocation data indicates that the push factors driving people out of the Sun Belt are no longer just abstract complaints, They aren't minor seasonal annoyances anymore.
Right. It is not just someone saying, oh, it's a bit warm today. I wish it were cooler. It's systemic.
Yeah. They have evolved into daily pressures that actively degrade your quality of life.
Let's talk about the heat, because the baseline has shifted dramatically. I mean, the 2020s are undeniably not the 1990s.
No, not even close.
We're looking at data showing Dallas hitting 45-plus days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in recent summers. Mm-hmm. And Austin endured that historically severe summer in 2023 with 45 consecutive days over 100.
And then you look at Houston, which is a completely different beast.
Yeah, Houston is not just dealing with the raw ambient temperature. It's that oppressive, heavy Gulf humidity. It creates a wet bulb temperature that is genuinely dangerous to human physiology.
Right. For families with young kids who need to burn off energy, or for people taking care of older parents who are sensitive to heat stroke, this weather literally forces them indoors for months at a time.
It's a massive contraction of their physical world. Yeah. You are essentially trapped in an air-conditioned box from June through September.
But that indoor confinement relies on one fundamental assumption, that the air conditioning is actually going to turn on when you flip the switch.
Oh, the grid.
Yeah. Which brings us to the second major push factor, and arguably the most psychologically damaging one. infrastructure anxiety.
It's so real.
The 2021 winter storm, the deep freeze that tragically resulted in hundreds of fatalities and left millions without power for days, that fundamentally fractured the social contract between Texas residents and their infrastructure.
It really did. People realized they were on their own.
Exactly. It shifted from being viewed as this weird anomaly to being processed as a collective trauma. And we saw echoes of that vulnerability again in 2025 with Winter Storm Fern, which triggered yet another Department of Energy emergency order for backup generation.
I always think of it like an analogy of an operating system on your phone, right? Think of your city's infrastructure like a background app.
Okay, I like that.
In a healthy, functioning city, the power grid is an app running smoothly in the background. You never look at it, you never actively think about it, and it consumes absolutely zero of your mental battery.
Right, you just assume the lights will turn on.
Exactly. But in Texas right now, the grid has become an app that is constantly crashing, constantly throwing up error notifications, and aggressively draining the resident's mental battery.
You're perpetually checking the ERCOT dashboard on your phone.
Yes. You're just constantly wondering, do we have enough generation capacity to make it through this afternoon?
What's fascinating here is how this fundamentally shifts the definition of livability for an entire demographic.
How so?
Well, for decades, livability in the Sun Belt was defined by private metrics, right? The square footage of your floor plan, the size of your backyard, the granite countertops, maybe your proximity to a community pool.
The classic American dream stuff.
Right. But now the baseline requirements are shifting toward public metrics and baseline resilience. Livability is increasingly being defined by asking, can I safely let my kids play outside in August without risking heat exhaustion?
Or can I trust my heater to keep my family warm when an Arctic front rolls through?
Exactly. And when the answer to those foundational questions becomes a maybe, the sheer size of your house starts to matter a whole lot less.
Absolutely.
And we have to look at the mechanics of why that grid anxiety exists. Texas operates an independent, isolated power grid. It is an island.
Right. Designed intentionally to avoid federal regulation.
Yeah. But the mechanical trade-off is that when demand spikes, when 10 million air conditioning units kick on simultaneously, Texas cannot easily pull reserve power from neighboring states like Louisiana or New Mexico.
There's no massive physical extension cord to plug into.
Exactly.
And the demand side of that equation is only getting heavier. The data shows that ERCOT is facing a projected 170% increase in grid connection requests over the next few years.
That is just a staggering number.
And it's not just population growth. A massive portion of that is driven by the expansion of data centers, which are incredibly power hungry.
So you have a grid that is an island facing a massive surge in industrial demand while dealing with increasingly extreme temperature swings.
That creates very legitimate, mathematically modeled fears that demand could simply outpace supply capacity during peak summer loads as early as 2026.
And whether a specific individual's personal risk of a blackout is high or low, you know, depending on their exact grid node, the overarching anxiety is incredibly valid. You cannot relax in your home if you are constantly worried the life support system of that home might fail.
For sure. And it is not just the grid and the heat draining that mental battery. The daily physical movement through the state is becoming harder. We are talking about the soul-crushing reality of Sunbelt sprawl.
Oh, the traffic.
Yeah. Austin, Dallas, and Houston consistently rank among the most challenging metros for commute times. The car dependency is absolute.
You look at the sprawl of Interstate 35 or the 610 loop in Houston.
Right. You have metro areas that span 50, 60, sometimes 70 miles in multiple directions. Hmm. This means long, grueling, high-stress drives are just baked into the cake of everyday living. You're spending hours of your week just staring at the bumper of an F-150.
And to provide a complete picture of the migration catalyst here, it is important to note that the relocation data does briefly mention the political environment.
Right, we should touch on that.
There are absolutely individuals who factor state-level politics into their relocation calculus. However, looking at the data completely impartially, and to be clear, we are not taking any political stance here. We are simply reporting the broker's empirical observations on the ground.
We're just looking at what the data says.
Exactly. And the data says the political climate is not the primary driver for the vast majority of these moves. The universal drivers, the catalysts that are pushing people out regardless of their political affiliation, are the worsening heat, the compounding property tax burden, and the daily friction of traffic and grid anxiety.
Because heat and taxes do not care how you vote.
Ye really don't.
So the push factors are massive. The psychological desire to leave the state is clearly established. But escaping Texas is one thing. Successfully buying into the Pacific Northwest is an entirely different mechanical beast.
Oh, absolutely.
How does the financial math actually work when you are trying to parachute into a market where the median home price in Bellingham is sitting at a very steep $710,000?
That is the pivotal financial hurdle. And to understand it, we have to look at the mechanics of an equity reset. The broker's analysis breaks down the actual transaction numbers for the first quarter of 2026.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Well, the first thing we need to do is completely discard the income tax argument. You hear it constantly in relocation discussions, people moving to save on income taxes.
Right, the classic reason to move to Florida or Texas.
Yeah, but for a Texan relocating to Washington State, that factor is completely moot. Both Texas and Washington are among the few states that have a 0% state income tax. That column is a wash.
Okay, so if it's not income tax, what is it?
The actual mechanical engine making this cross-country move possible is home equity. It is entirely about the capital you can extract from your Texas property and inject directly into the Bellingham market.
Okay, let's walk through those actual transaction numbers, because the analysis breaks them down city by city, and it creates very different realities depending on where you currently live.
Yeah, your starting point matters a lot.
Let's start with Austin. The data lists the Q1 2026 median sale price in Austin at approximately $540,000. Now, after subtracting the standard closing costs like agent commissions, title fees, prep work, which the broker estimates at around 6%, that Austin seller nets approximately $508,000 in cash.
That's a solid chunk of change.
Right. If that Austin seller wants to buy the median Bellingham home at $710,000, they can take that cash, put a massive 25% down payment on the new house, which is about $178,000, and they still walk away from the closing table holding roughly $330,000 in liquid reserve.
Wow.
Yeah. That is a highly functional, very comfortable move. The math works beautifully for the Austin transplant.
It functions beautifully for Austin because Austin experienced such extreme, unprecedented equity growth over the last decade. But geography dictates the friction of this move.
Okay, so what about Dallas?
Let's look at the mechanics for a family leaving the Dallas or Plano area. The median home price there is $435,000. After the 6% closing costs, that Dallas seller nets about $409,000.
Okay, so a bit lower.
Right. So suddenly you have a substantial $312,000 gap between what you netted and the Bellingham median of $710,000. The math gets tighter.
Yeah, that's a big jump.
It means realistically putting 20% down around $142,000, keeping about $267,000 in reserve, and taking out a much more substantial mortgage to cover the difference. Or it means having to deliberately target Bellingham's lower pricing tier, the $475,000 to $550,000 range.
It gets incredibly tight if you are coming from Houston or San Antonio. The data puts the Houston median at $342,000, netting the seller $322,000.
Yeah.
San Antonio has a median of $310,000, netting $291,000.
Yeah, those markets are tough to launch from.
If you are coming from one of those markets, you are almost exclusively restricted to that $500,000, $575,000 tier in Bellingham. And let's be honest about what that tier buys you in the Pacific Northwest.
It's not a mansion.
The broker describes it plainly. You are looking at smaller, significantly older homes. You are not getting new construction at that price point.
This is exactly where the financial shock sets in for a lot of buyers during their initial consultations. The math is undeniably tighter here than it is for, say, a Californian moving up to Washington.
Right, because they are often swimming in massive equity from a $2 million bungalow.
Exactly. For a Texan, unless you are exiting the very top tier of the Austin or Dallas markets, you are going to feel a squeeze. You are going to have to compromise.
So what does this all mean? I have to push back on this a little bit because we need to be realistic about human nature here.
Go for it.
Put yourself in the shoes of a listener in a Houston suburb like Katy or Cypress. You are telling me that I'm going to sell my sprawling 3,000 square foot, relatively new brick home with a massive backyard, a media room, and a three-car garage.
Right, the Texas dream home.
And the equity I pull out of that massive asset is going to barely get me into a 1970s split-level home in Bellingham that is literally half the size and probably needs a kitchen update. I mean, I am taking a massive, undeniable downgrade in house size and perceived architectural quality.
It definitely looks that way on paper.
So how does any real estate professional look a buyer in the eye and convince them that trading a mansion for a split level is actually a smart financial and lifestyle move?
It is the most common point of friction in the entire process.
Yeah.
And resolving it requires understanding a psychological and financial concept we can call functional equity.
Functional equity, okay.
The broker is absolutely not trying to convince the buyer that they are making a one-to-one architectural trade. They are not. You physically cannot replicate your sprawling Texas floor plan in Bellingham for the same price. The land values and building costs just make it impossible.
Right, you just can't do it.
What the analysis explains is that this relocation is not about replicating a physical structure. It is about shifting the environmental utility of your assets.
Right.
We have to look at how you actually use your space in Texas.
Okay, I'm listening.
Your equity is tied up in sheer indoor square footage. Why? Because you need a 3,000 square foot house so your family doesn't go stir crazy when it is 104 degrees outside for 3 months straight.
Oh, that's entirely true.
It's a survival mechanism. Your house is a massive, heavily air-conditioned fortress against a hostile environment.
So you are saying that in Texas, you buy a massive house because you are essentially forced to spend all your time inside it. And you are trading that indoor fortress for outdoor access.
Exactly. It's deeper than just a space trade. It is an environmental utility shift. You are downsizing your private, climate-controlled square footage, but you are drastically upgrading your environmental commons.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
You are buying into a climate where the ambient temperature allows you to actually be outside. You do not need a massive media room to keep the kids entertained in August, because they can be at the lake, on a hiking trail, or just riding bikes in the neighborhood without risking heat exhaustion.
But I imagine the psychology of downsizing is genuinely difficult.
Oh, it is. It requires letting go of the deeply ingrained cultural idea that a bigger house inherently equals a better, more successful life. But functional equity means your wealth is now deployed in a geographic location that allows you to live outside the walls of your house. Your living space expands into the public square, the parks, and the bay.
Okay, I see the lifestyle logic. I really do. I am trading my massive media room for actual mountains and ocean.
Yeah.
But building directly on my pushback about those high housing prices, because paying $710,000 for a smaller, older home is a very tough pill to swallow, you still have to pay the monthly carry costs on this new life.
Right, the monthly bills.
Yeah, if I am taking out a bigger mortgage to bridge the equity gap, my monthly payment is going up. How is this sustainable?
And this brings us to the most staggering part of the data. The hidden equalizer in the relocation math.
I love that term, hidden equalizer.
This is the mechanism that actually makes this move financially viable over time. Yes, we need to analyze the day-to-day cost of living, and specifically the stealth wealth generated by the structural property tax differential between the two states.
Okay, let's get into the taxes.
This is the absolute core financial engine of the entire relocation argument. As we said, Texas has no state income tax, so it funds its schools, its roads, and its county services almost entirely through property taxes.
Right. They have to get the money somehow.
And as a result, the effective property tax rates in Texas are punishingly high. They typically run between 1.6% and 1.8% of the assessed home value, and sometimes higher in new municipal utility districts.
It's just a huge chunk of change every year.
Washington also has no state income tax, but it funds its government differently. Primarily through a high sales tax, a business and occupation tax, and property taxes that are constitutionally limited in how fast they can grow.
So they cap the growth.
Right. Therefore, in Whatcom County, where Bellingham is located, the effective property tax rate runs between 0.71% and 0.85%.
That is a staggering structural difference, half the rate, basically.
It is. The analysis walks through a 20-year financial modeling scenario that is just mind-blowing. Let's actually look at the math step by step.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
Let's say you buy a $650,000 home in Bellingham. At a 0.78% effective tax rate, your annual property tax bill to the county is roughly $5,070.
Okay.
Now, if you owned a home of the exact same $650,000 value in a Texas suburb assessed at a 1.7% effective rate, your annual tax bill would be $11,050.
Whoa. So simply by choosing to live in the Bellingham house instead of the Texas house of the same value, you are saving approximately $5,980 every single year in tax liability.
Every single year. And here is where the mechanics of wealth building completely transform the narrative.
Tell me.
The broker calculates that if you took that $5,980 in annual tax savings money that you would have otherwise written a check for to a Texas County tax assessor, and you systematically invested it in a standard S&P 500 index fund, assuming a historical 7% average annualized return over a 20-year period.
Wait, I know this gets big. How big?
You would generate approximately $310,000 in compounded savings, over a quarter of $1 million.
That is insane.
That wealth is generated purely by the structural difference in how the two state legislatures have chosen to levy taxes. As the analysis notes, this $310,000 does not magically show up on day one at the closing table. It is invisible at first, but it fundamentally radically alters your financial trajectory over the long term.
It really makes me think of the Texas housing model as a kind of predatory subscription service.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. You save up, you buy the house, you own the asset outright, but you are forced to pay a massive, never-ending, ever-increasing subscription fee just to be allowed to exist inside it.
Yeah, you never really stop paying for it.
You have that massive property tax bill, and then on top of that, you have the massive summer electricity bill to power the air conditioning. Let's look at the overhead. The data points out that in a Texas home, a resident is bleeding $250 to $500 a month in July and August just to keep the house at 74 degrees.
Just burning cash to stay cool.
Exactly. And in Bellingham, the climate does the cooling for you. The vast majority of older homes in Bellingham do not even have central air conditioning. They don't need it. Your summer cooling bill literally drops to between $0 and $30 for running a few ceiling fans.
It is an incredible reduction in forced overhead. To expand on your subscription analogy, in Texas, that high escalating monthly subscription fee makes you highly vulnerable to localized inflation and aggressive appraisal hikes. You are at the mercy of the county appraiser.
Which is terrifying.
Bellingham, conversely, requires a very high upfront premium, the steep $710,000 purchase price of the asset, but it provides a drastically lower, more stable monthly subscription fee to maintain your existence there.
Okay, but let's look at the rest of the daily carry costs, because the listener needs the full microeconomic picture. The analysis says Washington car insurance is modestly lower because there are fewer massive hailstorms and major weather damage claims compared to Texas.
That's a nice little bonus.
But it is certainly not all savings. The cost of living in the Pacific Northwest has real friction.
Yeah.
Where is the listener going to bleed money?
Well, the analysis is very transparent about the consumption taxes that replace the property taxes. First and foremost, you will feel it at the pump. Gas.
Ah, right.
Washington has one of the highest gas taxes in the nation, plus a carbon pricing program that affects distribution costs. This pushes pump prices up to $4 to $4.30 a gallon, often higher.
Yeah, if you are accustomed to the $2.80 gas near the refineries in Houston, you're going to feel a sharp pinch every single time you fill your tank.
Definitely. Secondly, the combined state and local sales tax is higher. In Bellingham, it sits around 8.8% to 9.4%, whereas Texas generally caps out at 8.25%. Every time you buy a television, a pair of shoes, or a car, you are paying a premium to the state.
And the daily friction of buying food is higher. The data notes that Texas grocery costs are generally below the national average because of the massive agricultural and distribution networks there.
Right.
Washington grocery costs hover near or slightly above the national average.
And when you decide to go out to eat, you are directly funding Washington's higher labor standards.
Right. They have a high minimum wage.
Yeah. And service industry compensation is significantly better than in Texas. That is great for the workers, but mechanically, that cost is passed directly onto your dinner check.
Makes sense.
Oh, and we absolutely cannot forget the RETI, the real estate excise tax. This is a crucial mechanical difference.
What's the REIT?
When you eventually decide to sell your Washington home, the state hits the seller with a graduated excise tax that ranges from 1.1% to over 3.0%, depending on the sale price. Texas does not have an equivalent deed transfer tax. The state of Washington takes a bite of your equity on your way out the door.
Ouch. So they get you when you leave.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, particularly for someone nearing retirement, these structural differences are profound.
How so?
Consider a fixed income retiree living in a major Texas metro. They own their home free and clear, but they are incredibly vulnerable. If the real estate market booms and their property appraisal spikes, their property tax bill spikes alongside it.
And their pension doesn't go up to match it.
Exactly. Their fixed pension or Social Security suddenly does not cover their rising housing costs. They can literally be taxed out of a home they own.
That's just tragic.
In Washington, the lower effective tax rate and the state laws that limit how fast a county can increase its total property tax revenue offer a much wider, deeper moat of protection for a fixed income retiree. Yes, the cost of gas is higher. Yes, the sales tax is higher. But those are consumption taxes.
Right. You can control those.
Exactly. If money gets tight, you can control your consumption. You can drive less. You can buy fewer consumer goods. You cannot control your property tax assessment. You cannot opt out of it.
So the financial architecture, while requiring a tight squeeze up front to get into the market, shows a massive compounded long-term advantage for Bellingham. You are protected from the subscription fee trap.
Yeah, it's a huge shift in long-term security.
But here is the massive caveat to all of this.
Yeah.
All this financial modeling, all this compounded wealth in the S&P 500 is completely and utterly useless if you cannot mentally and physically survive the environment you are buying into.
You mean the weather?
Yes. You cannot spend that $310,000 if you move back to Texas after 24 months because you are horribly depressed. We have to look at the meteorological reality. We are talking about trading fire for water.
And this is where the broker's guidance becomes brutally candid. The data explicitly states that no other aspect of this relocation is as dramatic or as potentially derailing as the shift in the sky above you.
Let's start with the dream, right? The exact reason our listener in Texas is looking at Redfin right now. The Bellingham summer.
It's beautiful.
But data shows that July and August average high temperatures run around a perfect 72 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. The humidity is negligible. Locals actually start complaining that it's too hot when it hits 85.
Which a Texan would just laugh at.
The imagery the broker uses is wild to anyone living in the Sunbelt. Kids playing outside all day, all summer long, hiking and cycling, or taking a kayak out on the bay on a random Wednesday afternoon, simply because it is perfectly comfortable to do so.
You don't have to plan your outdoor life around the position of the sun.
That is the dream that sells the houses.
It is an incredible summer, but the mechanical price you pay for that perfect summer is the reality of the Pacific Northwest winter. And we must not sugarcoat this.
Me too.
From November through February, and often bleeding into spring, Bellingham sees cloud cover almost every single day. The raw meteorological statistics are startling. Bellingham averages 230 gray or overcast days per year.
230 days.
The analysis makes a point to clarify that this is not a typo. 230 days. To put that environmental shift in perspective, Dallas averages 234 sunny days a year. You are essentially taking your relationship with the sun and entirely inverting it.
It is just a constant, persistent, 9-month light drizzle. The data clarifies that the rain isn't violent. It is not a massive, apocalyptic Texas thunderstorm that floods the streets in 20 minutes. It is just a damp, gray reality that sits on top of the city.
And this has severe, documented medical implications. We aren't just talking about feeling a little gloomy. The analysis explicitly details SAD, seasonal affective disorder. It states very clearly that the disruption to your circadian rhythm, the drop in serotonin, and the melatonin imbalance caused by the lack of sunlight are real medical phenomena.
Wow.
Taking vitamin D supplements and using full-spectrum light therapy lamps in your home are not trendy wellness fads or podcast biohacks. They are mandatory, practical medical tools that residents use to functionally survive the winter.
The deficit of sunshine is profound. The meteorological data notes that in the absolute depths of winter, say in December, you might only see 8 to 12 hours of meaningful, direct sunshine for the entire month.
Compared to the 200-plus hours a Texan expects in a winter month?
That massive disparity is why Gennaro, the broker, has developed a very specific non-negotiable litmus test for his out-of-state clients. He tells them, do not visit Bellingham in July. Summer sells itself. Anyone can fall in love with 75 and sunny.
Oh, absolutely.
You must book your scouting trip in November or February. You need to walk around the historic Fairhaven neighborhood while it is drizzling and 42 degrees. You need to feel the dampness seep into your coat.
That's a great test.
If you could spend a week in January in that gray environment and still genuinely see yourself building a life there, then you are ready. But if you grow quiet and withdrawn on the drive back down to the airport, do not list your Texas house. You will not make it.
It's harsh, but necessary advice.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. It is a massive, almost tragic paradox. you have these Texans fleeing the Sun Belt because they are trapped indoors by the oppressive, dangerous heat. They're desperate to be outside.
Right.
But by executing this move to the Pacific Northwest, they are stepping into an environment where they could very easily end up trapped indoors again, this time by the gloom, the drizzle, and the seasonal depression. You are just trading a thermal prison for a meteorological one.
It is a sharp paradox. But there is a crucial psychological distinction that the analysis unpacks. We have to analyze the profound difference between what we can categorize as dangerous weather versus inconvenient weather.
That's a huge distinction.
In Texas, the weather is increasingly dangerous. The 105-degree ambient heat carries genuine heat stroke risks. The freezing temperatures during an ERCOT grid failure threaten your physical safety. Those extremes threaten your life.
Yeah, people die in those events.
Exactly. In Bellingham, the winter weather is rarely, if ever, dangerous. The temperatures rarely drop below 28 degrees. There are hardly any major ice events that paralyze the streets. There is no brutal, biting wind chill. The Bellingham winter is an inconvenience. It threatens your mood. It saps your energy levels. It requires you to wear a Gore-Tex jacket, but it does not threaten your life.
And the local infrastructure actually supports that baseline safety. We talked about ERCOT failing earlier. The analysis explains the mechanics of Washington's grid. Puget Sound Energy, the local utility, runs on a highly robust Pacific Northwest hydro grid. They're using dams and gravity to generate power.
Hydro is incredibly stable.
Right. Because of that stable hydroelectric base, outages in Bellingham are almost entirely localized physical weather events. A tree branch snaps under the weight of wet snow and falls on a specific local distribution line. The power goes out for your street, the utility crew removes the branch, and the power is back in 3 hours.
It is not a systemic statewide generation failure where the state literally does not have enough electricity to keep the hospitals running.
Precisely. So the core trade-off is profound. But it's fundamentally a choice between enduring physical anxiety in Texas, worrying about survival systems, versus managing psychological endurance in Washington, managing your mood and your serotonin levels.
All right, let's assume our listener has flown up in February, passed the drizzle litmus test, bought a full spectrum lamp, and accepted the gray sky. Now we hit the economic and cultural reality check. Because even if you can survive the winter without getting depressed, you still have to pay for those more expensive groceries and figure out how to navigate the social scene in a drizzly town.
Let's look at the local economy.
The local job market is perhaps the tightest constraint detailed in the analysis outside of the weather itself. We have to look at the scale. Bellingham is a small city of roughly 100,000 people.
Very different from Dallas.
Exactly. It physically and economically does not have the professional density of an Austin tech hub. It does not have the massive energy industry of Houston. And it does not have the sprawling corporate financial sector of Dallas. If you are seeking local employment, the data points out that the job market is heavily concentrated in very specific sectors. Healthcare, primarily through Peace Health, which is the largest employer, higher education through Western Washington University, retail, and maritime or construction trades.
And the financial reality of those local jobs is tough. The analysis explicitly warns about salary compression. If you leave a mid-level corporate job in Dallas and try to find a local equivalent in Bellingham, you are almost certainly going to take a significant pay cut. The local wages simply do not match the Texas metros.
That's a tough reality to face.
Now, the cost of living offset with the lower property taxes helps cushion that blow, but the broker admits it does not fully close the gap. This fundamental economic reality is why the data states that remote work is the dominant pattern for these Texas to Bellingham buyers. The vast majority of them are not looking for local jobs. They are bringing their Texas or national salaries with them via laptop.
And that remote work dynamic introduces its own fascinating logistical quirks, primarily driven by the time zone difference. There is a 2-hour gap between Central Standard Time in Texas and Pacific Standard Time in Washington.
Before we get to the daily schedule of that time zone shift, let's talk about the travel logistics for that remote worker. Let's say you are remote, but you still have to commute back to the home office in Texas once a month for face-to-face meetings. It is a grueling trek.
It really is.
The analysis is very clear on the mechanics of this. Bellingham International Airport, BLI, is a small regional airport. It is fantastic if you want a cheap direct Allegiant flight to Vegas for the weekend, but it is entirely useless for regular business commuting to the Sun Belt. There are no direct flights to Austin, Dallas, or Houston.
Right. The flight routing from BLI usually forces a layover in Seattle anyway, turning what should be a straightforward trip into a 5 to 7 hour ordeal.
Which nobody wants to do every month.
Exactly. So the practical mechanical reality for the business traveler is that you are driving your car 90 miles south down Interstate 5 to Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, SeaTac, depending on Seattle traffic. That is a 1.5 to 2 hour drive before you even walk through the sliding doors to get to your gate.
That physical friction is a massive factor you must calculate if your job requires heavy travel.
For sure.
But getting back to the daily remote work and the culture, listening to these constraints, it really sounds to me like moving to Bellingham is the equivalent of transferring from a massive, chaotic, high-stakes corporate headquarters to a quiet, boutique satellite office.
I love that analogy. Boutique satellite office.
Right. The baseline pace of life is significantly better. The analysis notes that traffic, as a Texan understands it, literally does not exist. A bad commute in Bellingham means you hit 3 red lights and it takes 15 minutes instead of 10. The baseline stress is undeniably lower. But the ceiling on your career advancement locally, the variety of your dining options, the sheer volume of your networking opportunities, that ceiling is undeniably lower too.
The boutique satellite office analogy captures the mechanical shift perfectly. But let's look at the hidden, massive advantage of that remote setup. Specifically, the mechanics of the time zone shift. For a remote worker who is required to keep Texas hours, that 2-hour shift actually creates a hidden superpower.
I'm intrigued. What superpower?
If your company expects you to be online from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Time in Bellingham, your workday starts at 7 a.m. Pacific Time. That is early, yes, but very manageable. The magic happens at the end of the day. You log off at 3 p.m. local time.
Oh, wow.
That schedule gives you hours of usable daylight, even during the shorter shoulder seasons, to hit a mountain biking trail on Galbraith Mountain, to take a paddleboard out on Bellingham Bay, or to just enjoy the afternoon before you even have to think about dinner. It dramatically expands your usable outdoor leisure time.
That is a massive lifestyle upgrade. You get your life back at 3 p.m. But the question is, who are you going paddleboarding with? Because the analysis brings up a major cultural hurdle, the notorious Seattle freeze.
Yes, the freeze.
We have to look at the sociology of the Pacific Northwest. The data points out that while Texans are famously warm, instantly hospitable, and will strike up a conversation with you in the grocery checkout line, the Pacific Northwest runs much cooler on first contact. The locals are polite, they are not hostile or rude, but they're highly reserved. They respect privacy almost to a fault.
It's just a different social norm.
They're not going to invite you over for a backyard barbecue the day you unload your moving truck. The broker estimates it takes an average of 6 months of consistent effort to really break in, to establish a genuine network by joining a cycling group, volunteering, or becoming a recognized regular at a local coffee shop.
It requires a fundamental shift in your social expectations. You have to be patient and deliberate. And speaking of shifting expectations, the analysis dedicates a very somber, honest note to the food culture.
Yes, we need a moment of silence here for the culinary losses. The guide bluntly states, RIP breakfast tacos and brisket.
A true tragedy.
You are leaving behind a deeply ingrained, incredible regional food identity. Authentic Tex-Mex, the slow-smoked barbecue culture. It simply does not translate 2,000 miles north. The mechanics of the food supply and the cultural history are just different.
You're not going to find it up there.
You are trading that for a very different, very specific culinary scene. Bellingham offers phenomenal farm-to-table cooking, serious third-wave coffee roasters, incredible local seafood and oysters pulled right out of the sound, and a massive, deeply integrated craft beer culture with places like Kulshan and Boundary Bay. The broker wisely advises his clients, do not go out searching for a Texas barbecue joint in Bellingham. You will only be disappointed. Let the local food be its own thing.
So if a listener has absorbed all of this friction, they have run the property tax math, they have accepted the 230 days of gray, they are prepared to navigate the Seattle freeze, and they have mourned the loss of breakfast tacos, and they are still fully on board, the next logical step is geography.
Right. Where do you actually move?
Having established the lifestyle mechanics, we need to look at the map. Where specifically should they tell their real estate broker to start hunting?
This is where the analysis provides what is essentially a cultural translation map. It does not just list zip codes. It correlates specific Texas psychological profiles and vibes to specific Bellingham neighborhoods and school systems. Let's start with the educational mechanics, because that is a massive driver for families.
Oh, education is huge for these moves.
The analysis notes a fundamental shift in how education is approached. Texas features those massive, heavily funded suburban districts with intense college prep cracks, massive football stadiums, and a heavy, high-stakes emphasis on stair standardized testing, which dictates funding.
Right, the Friday Night Lights culture.
In Bellingham Public Schools, that high-stakes, standardized testing culture is largely absent. The district operates on a different philosophy, described as much more progressive, with a heavy emphasis on project-based learning, integrating outdoor education into the curriculum, and maintaining smaller class sizes.
The analysis also provides mechanical alternatives for families who might want a different environment. For those seeking a more traditional, perhaps culturally conservative, educational environment that feels more reminiscent of a classic Texas suburb, the guide points them toward the Linden School District, located out in the county.
That's a good option to have.
And crucially, it highlights the financial mechanics of Western Washington University. For a Texas family staring down the escalating tuition costs of UT Austin or Texas A&M, WWU is a massive asset. It offers top-tier liberal arts and environmental science programs, and mechanically, a student qualifies for highly subsidized in-state tuition after just 12 months of established residency. That is a huge financial lever for families migrating with teenagers.
Okay, let's map out the actual neighborhoods. The analysis groups these into categories based on the buyer's psychological priorities. Let's look at the walkability premium buyer. If you insist on walking to get your morning coffee and one historical charm, you are looking at Fairhaven.
Fairhaven is beautiful.
The guide compares this to Austin's central neighborhoods, or the historic Lakewood area of Dallas. It features Victorian-era brick buildings, independent bookstores, artisan coffee shops, and the actual ferry terminal to the San Juan Islands. It is highly walkable. But here is the mechanical trade-off the broker warns about. To get that walkability, you are sacrificing massive square footage. You are looking at tight lots, older homes, and steep prices ranging from $700,000 to well over $1.1 million just for character and location.
Right. Fairhaven is for the buyer who wants to fundamentally alter their daily routine by removing the car from the equation. Now contrast that with the suburban import buyer. If you want to maintain your current lifestyle, you look at Barkley in Northeast Bellingham.
Okay, what's Barkley like?
The guide compares the Barkley vibe to Plano, Frisco, or the Woodlands. This is for the buyer who wants the familiar suburban pattern. Newer construction, attached two-car garages, wide, quiet streets, excellent school proximity, and a master plan shopping center within a five-minute drive. You keep your car-centric routine, but in a cooler climate. The pricing here is slightly more accessible, ranging from $550,000 to $750,000.
Then you have the ultimate privacy buyer looking at Edgemore in Northwest Bellingham. The guide describes this area as having established mid-century architecture, sprawling lots, mature, dense tree canopies, and a strong, quiet culture overlooking Bellingham Bay. It does not have the immediate walkability of Fairhaven, but it offers immense character and seclusion. Prices there run steep, from $700,000 to $1.1 million.
And for younger professional families.
For them, perhaps coming from the urban core of Austin or Houston, the guide points to Sihome. It is situated right near the WW campus, providing a great mix of walkability and residential calm. It is highly bikeable, deeply integrated with the university energy, and priced in the $580,000 to $750,000 range. And finally, for the pragmatic buyer, there is South Hill, located just south of downtown, right near Whatcom Falls Park, which the guide notes is one of the premier urban parks in the entire Pacific Northwest. It has excellent transit access and serves as the primary entry point pricing for proper city limits Bellingham, running $500,000 to $700,000.
There is one crucial overarching caveat the analysis makes for migrating Texans, however. We call it the acreage caveat.
The acreage caveat. I'm listening.
If you are a Texan coming north with visions of owning 2, 5, or 10 acres of sprawling land, you will absolutely not find that within the Bellingham city limits. The urban growth boundaries prevent it. If you want Texas-scaled land, you have to look outside the city into Whatcom County to places like Ferndale or Linden. These areas offer larger plots and a distinctly rural agricultural character while mechanically still being a 20 to 30-minute drive from Bellingham's core services.
I just marvel at the accuracy of this translation map. You obviously cannot put your brick Texas house on a flatbed truck and haul it 2,000 miles, but you can apparently import your exact Texas suburban psychological identity right into the Barkley neighborhood, or your Austin urbanist identity right into Fairhaven.
This raises an important question, though, about the mechanical scale of daily life. In a massive, sprawling metro like Dallas or Houston, your social life, your favorite restaurants, and your entertainment might be spread across a 40-minute, 30-mile driving radius.
Oh, easily.
The analysis notes that in Bellingham, the physical scale collapses. Getting almost anywhere takes 10 to 15 minutes. That means your neighborhood selection in this smaller city heavily, aggressively dictates your entire social reality. Your 15-minute radius is your whole world.
That is a wild thought.
If you choose Fairhaven, your life will organically revolve around walking to the bookstore and the bay. If you choose Ferndale, your life revolves around your acreage and the deliberate drive into town. The neighborhood choice creates much more friction and defines your daily routine far more rigidly here than it does in a sprawling metropolis where you are used to driving everywhere anyway.
All right, so let's put it all together. Our listener has done the compounding tax math. They have accepted the rain. They have kept their remote job to exploit the time zone hack. And they have identified a split-level home in Berkeley that fits their suburban profile.
They're ready to pull a trigger.
Now comes what sounds like the most terrifying, high-anxiety part of the entire process. The logistics of a blind or semi-blind leap. How do you mechanically execute the purchase of a $700,000 highly illiquid asset from two time zones away?
The analysis reveals that this blind purchase scenario happens far more frequently than you might assume. Roughly a third of this specific broker's Texas to Bellingham pipeline involves buyers closing on a home they have only physically stood inside of once, and a growing percentage by entirely sight unseen.
Wow, really? Sight unseen.
Yeah, and the way they execute this is a testament to how standardized and frictionless the modern real estate transaction mechanics have become.
Let's break down the mechanics of how you mitigate the risk of buying a house through a screen. The process starts with the FaceTime walkthrough. And the broker is not just walking through holding a phone, showing off the pretty granite kitchen counters and the fresh paint.
They have to do a lot more than that.
The analysis explains that the broker acts as the buyer's proxy sensory organs. The broker is climbing up into the attic spaces, pointing the camera at the insulation and the HVAC ducting. More importantly, they are narrating the physical realities that a camera lens cannot capture. They are honestly describing the ambient smells of the neighborhood, the decibel level of the road noise from a nearby arterial street, and the physical slope and drainage of the driveway. They are translating the physical world into data for the remote buyer.
And if a property passes that rigorous FaceTime sensory test, the buyer then executes what the analysis calls a surgical 3-day scouting trip.
Sounds intense.
The mechanical template for this is highly precise to minimize disruption. You fly into SeaTac on a Thursday, you spend Friday and Saturday viewing 6 to 8 highly vetted pre-selected properties, and you fly back to Texas on Sunday. That intense, exhausting 48-hour window is designed to give you just enough physical, tactile context to make a massive financial commitment.
I have to admit, buying a house based on a FaceTime call and a whirlwind weekend trip feels incredibly risky. If we use an analogy, it feels less like a calculated investment and more like walking a financial tightrope without a net. You are putting hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line based on a 30-minute walkthrough.
It definitely feels like a tightrope, but the analysis details how the Washington State real estate contracts mechanically function as a massive safety net. Let's look at how the risk is actually mitigated by the paperwork. First, the earnest money, the deposit you put down to secure the contract, typically runs 1% to 3% of the purchase price in Washington.
Okay, so what does that look like?
So on a $650,000 home, you are wiring roughly $6,500 to $19,500 into an escrow account. That is your exposure. But the true mechanical safety net is the standard 10-day inspection contingency.
Explain how that contingency actually protects the blind buyer.
During those 10 business days after the contract is signed, you hire a licensed, independent local inspector. They comb through the house. If that inspector finds fundamental structural problems that were not visible on FaceTime, say a cracked foundation, failing plumbing, or a roof that needs immediate replacement, and you decide you cannot accept those flaws, you pull the mechanical ripcord.
You just walk away.
You formally walk away from the contract, and by state law, escrow returns your earnest money in full. The contract is designed to protect the buyer from unseen defects. You are not trapped.
And the actual closing process, the transferring of the deed, has been completely digitized to remove the geographic friction. You do not have to buy another plane ticket to fly back up to Washington just to sit in a stuffy title office and sign papers.
That's a huge relief for people.
The analysis notes that DocuSign handles almost all the preliminary disclosures and contract adjustments. For the final official deed recordings that require a wet signature, the title company hires a mobile notary who will literally drive to your current living room anywhere in Texas, verify your ID, and overnight the documents back to Washington.
The most complex mechanical friction is usually the financial timing. Buying a house before you have sold your current one is always stressful. The analysis notes that if you need to move fast to secure a highly desirable Bellingham home before your Texas house closes, there are standard financial tools available. Bridge loans or home equity lines of credit drawn against your unsold Texas equity are commonly used to float the cash gap.
So they can make the timing work.
The broker explicitly connects these migrating buyers with local Washington lenders who are highly experienced in underwriting this exact interstate wealth transfer pattern. They know how to structure the loans to bridge the gap until the Texas deed transfers.
Okay, so the contracts are signed. The mobile notary has left your Texas driveway. The title is recorded. Now you have to actually physically move your life, your furniture, and your family 2,000 miles across the country.
The hard part.
The relocation analysis provides the brutal line item logistical costs for this physical movement. If you want a full-service, white-glove interstate moving company to pack up your four-bedroom house in Austin or Houston, drive it 2,400 miles, and unpack it in your new Bellingham living room, you are looking at spending a massive premium between $9,000 and $22,000, depending on the exact weight of your load.
For those who want to mitigate that cost, the container logistics offer an alternative. Using services like PODS or UPAC, where you load the container yourself and they handle the freight transport, runs between $4,000 and $9,000.
That's a bit more manageable.
However, the mechanical trade-off there is time. You have to budget 2 to 4 weeks for the container to actually make the transit via freight networks. And interestingly, regarding vehicles, the analysis notes that most relocating Texas buyers do not subject themselves to the grueling 4-day drive up the spine of the country. They ship their cars on an open transport carrier, which adds another mechanical cost of roughly $1,100 to $1,800 per vehicle to the total relocation budget.
So while the digital friction of the real estate transaction is remarkably low, the actual physical cost of moving your material life is still a massive upfront hurdle. It is a logistical and financial mountain you have to climb. But once you have paid the movers, once you have flown up, and once you unpack that first box in your new living room, you are in. You have successfully executed a total structural reset of your environmental, financial, and cultural reality.
You have completed the pipeline. You have traded the grid anxiety for the hydro dam stability, the property tax drain for the compounding equity, and the thermal confinement for the public outdoors.
So if you are that listener we talked about at the beginning, sitting there in Texas right now, wiping the sweat off your forehead, looking at that terrifying county property tax bill, and wondering if there is a way out,
Yeah. You
now have the unvarnished truth.
You have the exact mechanical math.
You understand the hidden mechanism of the $310,000 compounded property tax savings that makes the higher Washington purchase price not just sustainable, but lucrative. You know the visceral reality of the 230 days of gray skies and why vitamin D is a medical necessity, not a suggestion.
You understand how the 2-hour remote work time zone hack can give you your afternoons and your life back.
You are equipped to look completely past the glossy real estate marketing hype and understand exactly, dollar for dollar and day for day, what it takes to trade the Texas furnace for the Pacific Northwest drizzle.
And as we close this analysis, I want to leave you with one final provocative thread to pull. Something the data strongly implies regarding the future. We spent a lot of time today grappling with Bellingham's current median price tag, meticulously analyzing how steep that $710,000 number feels right now, today. But I want you to consider the long-term trajectory of the national climate and migration map.
Where's it all heading?
As extreme heat, dangerous wet bulb humidity, and compounding grid instability continue to relentlessly push populations and wealth out of the Sun Belt, geographic locations like Bellingham, places that natively offer mild summers, robust gravity-fed infrastructure, and limitless access to fresh water, are rapidly transitioning from simply being nice, scenic places to live to being absolute premium survival commodities.
Oh, survival commodities.
The provocative question for you to mull over as you listen to your AC unit struggle against the heat isn't just whether you can mathematically afford Bellingham today. The ultimate question is whether a decade from now, Bellingham's $710,000 price tag is going to look like the greatest financial and environmental bargain you ever missed.